From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Senator Joe Lieberman and his wife Hadassah. On Monday, the senator announced he's running for president. This week, the Liebermans also started a tour to promote their new book, which is a memoir about the 2000 presidential campaign. Also today, a mother-daughter memoir of the fight for civil rights. We talk with Patricia Stevens Due, who became an activist in the 60s in segregated Florida, and her daughter Tanana Reeve Due, who grew up in integrated neighborhoods and faced different issues than her mother. Their new book is called Freedom in the Family. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. UN weapons inspectors found some empty chemical warheads at an ammunition storage area in Iraq today. NPR's Kate Seeley has the latest from Baghdad.
A spokesman for UN monitors said that during a visit to an ammunitions storage area, a team of inspectors discovered 11 empty warheads in excellent condition, apparently designed to carry chemical warfare agents. Now, the find was made during an inspection of some bunkers south of Baghdad. It seems inspectors used portable X-ray equipment to conduct analysis of the warheads, and it wasn't immediately clear if they had ever contained banned chemicals or not.
NPR's Kate Seeley reporting from Baghdad. The inspectors also found a 12th warhead that they say needs more evaluation. Iraqi officials said the missiles are short-range weapons that were brought into the country in 1988. They claim the missiles were mentioned in Iraq's declaration of weapons last month. White House spokesman Scott McClellan declined to comment on the significance of the discovery until the Bush administration has more word from the inspectors. A federal magistrate in Lubbock, Texas, has ordered a Texas Tech University professor held in jail without bond on charges of lying to the FBI about the destruction of 30 vials of deadly plague bacteria. The FBI says Dr. Thomas Butler, a tenured professor at the university, admitted that he told his supervisor that the plague bacteria was missing when in fact it had been accidentally destroyed. Butler reportedly said he didn't realize his story would set off such an extensive investigation. In a statement, Butler said he knew that the bacteria had been destroyed and it did not pose a threat. The report that the bacteria were missing triggered a terrorism alert and drew about 60 investigators from the FBI and other agencies. President Bush called today for limits on medical malpractice awards, which he says would lower health care costs. Democrats say the president's proposals would help big insurance companies at the expense of malpractice victims. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
The president, at a speech in Scranton, Pennsylvania, said he wants to cap damage awards for pain and suffering in malpractice lawsuits at $250,000. Without that, he said, insurance costs for doctors will continue to be driven upward.
We're a litigious society. Everybody's suing, it seems like. There are too many lawsuits in America, and there are too many lawsuits filed against doctors and hospitals without merit.
Last year, the U.S. House passed malpractice reforms the president called for, but the Democratic-controlled Senate rejected them. Now Republicans control both the House and Senate. Consumer groups say the White House proposals are great for insurance companies, but not for victims of medical malpractice. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
In stocks today, the Dow lost 25 points to close at 86.98. This is NPR News. AOL Time Warner says that Chief Executive Dick Parsons will also assume the post of chairman. Parsons will take over the job from Steve Case, who announced last week that he'll resign effective in May. Case helped to arrange America Online's $106 billion merger with Time Warner, but was widely blamed when the merger didn't yield the results that some investors expected. Shark populations in the Atlantic have declined dramatically over the past 15 years, that's according to a study published in Science magazine. NPR's Richard Harris reports.
Researchers at Dalhousie University in Nova Scotia studied sharks that live far out in the Atlantic Ocean. They examined reports of the fish caught accidentally on lines set out for tuna and swordfish. Almost all these incidental shark catches declined by at least 50% over the past 15 years. Some species, like the hammerhead and great white, declined even more. Hammerheads declined by 90% since the mid-1980s. Most of the sharks in the study aren't fished for deliberately, but other fishermen frequently catch these species by mistake. They are thrown back, dead or alive. Richard Harris, NPR News, Washington.
General Electric workers are back on the job today after a two-day strike that was designed to protest the company's plan to shift more health care costs to the employees. The strike involved about 18,000 union workers. The company wants workers to assume an increase in co-payments that went up by about $200 per person at the start of this year. In stocks today, the NASDAQ Composite Index lost 14 points, or 1%, to close at 1,424. The S&P 500 lost 3 points to close at 914. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Air Products, providing gases and chemicals understanding to technology, energy, healthcare, and industrial markets worldwide. airproducts.com/info.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Senator Joe Lieberman announced on Monday that he's running for president. This week not only kicks off that campaign, it's the start of his book tour. The senator and his wife, Hadassah Lieberman, have written a memoir called An Amazing Adventure about the 2000 presidential campaign in which Joe Lieberman was the first Jewish vice presidential candidate. Yesterday, I recorded an interview with the Liebermans. In the book, the three-time senator from Connecticut says he will always feel that many more people went to the polls intending to vote for him and Al Gore, but did not have their votes counted. I asked him how his opinion that he and Gore should have won the election is affecting his interactions with President Bush.
People ask me, how do you feel about 2000? And I say what I think Hadassah and I convey in the book. I loved every minute of it until the end. In the end, was disappointing, infuriating, all of that. But I don't forget that, because there were a lot of people who tried to vote who didn't get their vote counted, and that's why we finally adopted election law reform this year. And I hope that President Bush will help us put some money in it to make it real. But it's my nature to go on, to learn from what happened. And as a result, I have a responsibility as a senator to try to work with the president when I agree with him, and to be honest enough to tell him quite explicitly when I disagree.
Your new book is about the experiences on the campaign trail, and you call it An Amazing Adventure. That's the title of the book. It also sounds pretty grueling. Hadassah Lieberman, how do you feel about going through this again and going through it with your husband being the presidential, not the vice presidential candidate, which will make it even more grueling?
Well, obviously, it's personally challenging to one's relationship and to one's family life, because that's just the nature of what a national campaign demands. But at the same time, it's an incredible opportunity, and it's important, I believe, if you believe in yourself, which Joe does and which we do in Joe and what he has to offer this country, to take that challenge and not shirk from it.
Joe Lieberman, how does candidate George Bush compare with President George W. Bush?
I hesitated a moment because I was trying to remember during the campaign. Look, there are differences here, and that's part of why I'm running. The president, as a candidate, promised he would change the tone in Washington, and the sad fact is that the tone is more partisan and polarized today than it was before he took office. And that's not just a matter of observing a conflict. It means that we're not doing what we should do to revive the economy, to improve our healthcare system, to protect our environment, to do something about energy, education, et cetera, et cetera. The president also campaigned on this promise to return integrity and honor to the Oval Office. And I think in too many of his policies, he has yielded to either big financial interests or extreme ideologues. And here again, I'm talking about environmental protection. I mean, it comes to mind. It's been important to me, a priority of mine for my entire political career. And this President Bush has torn apart a bipartisan consensus on protecting our natural resources and protecting us, our health, from air and water pollution that existed at least back to his father's administration, and in some senses back to the Nixon administration when the environmental movement started. So one of the premises of my campaign is that President Bush promised us a better America in 2000, and 2 years later, that promise has not been kept.
During George W. Bush's presidential campaign, some of his critics felt that he wasn't coming across as very smart. He stumbled a lot when it came to foreign policy and the names of foreign leaders. He wasn't well-traveled. Now he's facing a war with Iraq, problems with North Korea, a war on terrorism. Do you think that he is different now than you thought he would be? How is he handling in the international crises we face compared to how you thought he would do?
Mm-hmm. Any president in office learns. So I'd say on international and foreign policy, President Bush's record has been mixed. I happen to agree with him, as you probably know, in Iraq. I felt for a long time that we had to disarm Saddam or we would pay a terrible price for not doing so. I think that the president's response to September 11th was strong. On the other hand, I think he's been much more inclined to use the military and threats in regard to the Islamic world and North Korea than trying diplomacy, or with particular regard to the Islamic world, trying economic aid, better communication, creating more freedom in that world. I think the current crisis in North Korea has been the most inept chapter of the Bush foreign policy record, where he has been weak and inconsistent. And as a result, what was a difficult situation on the Korean Peninsula with a unpredictable tyrant, Kim Jong-il, has become a dangerous crisis. At one point, the president was against negotiations. Now, finally, he seems to be coming back to it. At one point, he took the military option toward Korea off the table for the first time since Dean Acheson did it prior to the Korean War. And some people think it helped to bring about, unfortunately, the Korean War. So it's a mixed record on foreign policy. And look, sometimes people say, a lot of senators are running this year, but there's a reason for that. The world has come home to America, and America needs strong and wise leadership in its relations with the rest of the world to protect our security and improve our economy. And I think senators have some unique experience, I certainly think I do, as a member of the Armed Services Committee, to bring to this most important job.
My guests are Joe and Hadassah Lieberman. They've written a new book about the 2000 campaign trail. It's called An Amazing Adventure. Joe Lieberman, you were the first Jewish candidate on a presidential ticket. You write in your book, "No one could predict how voters would take it. Would my religion become a factor in a close race? Was it worth the risk to see if the country was ready for a Jewish vice president?" You say that you suspected that the fear of anti-Semitism would be greater than the actual anti-Semitism you encountered. Did that prove to be true, and do you feel that you faced any coded anti-Semitism, anti-Semitism that was kind of, you know, cloaked in other language?
No, I don't think I did, and I do think it did prove to be true. It was, in that sense, a very validating, inspiring experience that, you know, the promise of America that we'll all get treated fairly. Doesn't matter who you are or where you started. If you've got what it takes to do the job, people will judge you on that basis. I felt that all around the country. There was a rush of focus on my religion when I was first selected, for obvious reasons. I was a first. But by the end of the campaign, there was hardly a mention of my religion. And that's just the way I wanted it to be. I wanted to be judged on my merits or demerits, and that's the greatness of the American people. I think that's exactly what they did. You know, people voted for what they thought was best for the future of the country, not on the irrelevant question of the adjective that goes before the important noun that describes me, which is American.
It's really good to hear that you don't think you faced anti-Semitism when you ran for vice president. The anti-Semitism factor has just changed a bit since September 11th. We've seen a lot of Islamic extremists see the United States as part of the Zionist conspiracy. Some extremists think the Israelis are responsible for the World Trade Center attacks. I want to read you something that was written on January 11th in the Daily Telegraph of London in an article by David Rennie. He writes, "Even commentators who profess no anti-Semitic beliefs have raised concerns about whether a Jewish president might be a liability at a time of Middle Eastern crisis and surging anti-Americanism in the Muslim world. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I think better of the Muslim world and the Arab world than to think that they will determine their relations with America based on the religion or anything else of the president. If you're president of the United States, this, the greatest power in the world, everyone else in the world will deal with you based on your policies, not on your religion or gender or race or anything else. And that's the key question. I mean, look, the United States today, unfortunately, is much less respected and liked in the world than we were 2 years ago. That has nothing to do with the religion of President Bush or anything. It has to do with his policies, the way in which the rest of the world thinks he's followed too often a unilateralist or arrogant foreign policy. And I think the world is much fairer than that commentary suggested. I can tell you in my own career in the Senate, you know, I've spent a lot of time, because I'm on the Armed Services Committee, concerned about our foreign and defense policy, have had established long relationships with leaders in the Arab world. Just visited the Middle East over the Christmas holidays, mostly to see American troops abroad, but met with leaders in the Arab world and, you know, was greeted with great warmth and respect as a friend. As an American senator, as somebody who they understood was thinking about running for president of the United States. So I think that's really not a factor. Now, look, I'm not talking about that small group of extreme fanatics like bin Laden who hate anybody who's not like him, hate Jews, hate Christians, hate Muslims who are not of his brand of Islam.
You said that you grew up without anti-Semitism and that most of your friends weren't even Jewish when you were growing up. Hadassah Lieberman, your parents were survivors of the Holocaust. They're from Prague, where you were born. What did it mean to them to have your husband run for vice president of the United States?
My father's not alive, and my mother, she was thrilled. She knows what Joe's all about, and she knows he's capable, and they're with him. So the truth is that my parents came to this country for the hope that it offered them, the hope of democracy, of raising their two children in freedom, and ultimately having a son-in-law who's running for president. So for my parents, I think the point is that 60-plus years ago, they ran away from totalitarianism. And, you know, we're no longer there. We're in a free democracy, and we have to be proud of it. And that was some of what I found when we went across the country in 2000.
My guests are Hadassah and Joe Lieberman. They've written a memoir about the 2000 presidential campaign called An Amazing Adventure. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guests are Joe and Hadassah Lieberman. They've written a new book about the 2000 campaign trail. It's called An Amazing Adventure. There's been a pretty rocky transition of power from the Democratic to Republican majority in the Senate. As we record this on Wednesday morning, the Democrats and Republicans have been unable to reach agreement on the split of committee financing and office space. And until they do reach agreement, Democrats remain in charge of the committees. Is this the most divided Senate you've seen, Joe Lieberman?
Unfortunately, there's been too much division over the 15 years that I've been in the Senate. But right now, this is pretty serious division, and it's too bad with the great crisis that we face as a country. And I, you know, the next election plays too much of a part in the way both parties conduct themselves. Whereas the people want us to get together and get something done for the country. And Lord knows we've got a lot of unfinished work to do on homeland security, on health care, on education, and most of all right now on the economy. So It's bad now. It's probably as bad as I've seen it, but unfortunately it's not uniquely bad in the 15 years I've been in the Senate.
You are one of the sponsors of the Homeland Security bill. How is our Homeland Security coming, in your opinion? Not long ago, you said that you thought that, with the exception of new airline security, we're only slightly safer than we were on September 11th. Do you still feel that way?
I'm afraid that is still my opinion, and it's one of the reasons that I'm running for president. Within a matter of, 3 or 4 weeks after September 11th, I, together with two or three other colleagues, including a Republican colleague in the Senate, Arlen Specter, introduced a bill to create a Homeland Security Department. President Bush was opposed to it for more than 8 months and then flip-flopped it, came out in favor of it. But we lost 8 important months there in which we could have better organized our defenses. They're very disorganized now, and that disorganization is dangerous. It's not only common sense, it's our constitutional responsibility to provide for the common defense, and that today means homeland defense. And we can't do this without being willing to invest some money. And this is something else I'm going to argue very strongly about President Bush's priorities. In fact, he's trying now to get the Republicans in control of Congress to cut back on the money that we should be spending to support local firefighters, police officers, and the Homeland Security Department. And you're just not going to make America safer at home unless you're willing to invest some money into it. So I think the president's priorities here are all wrong, and as a result, the American people indeed are not much safer from terrorist attack, I'm sorry to say, here at home than they were on September 11th.
Joe Lieberman, in 1991, you co-sponsored with Senator John Warner of Virginia the Senate resolution that authorized the first President Bush to go to war against Saddam Hussein. After the war, you expressed your regret that we ended the war without removing Saddam Hussein from power. In 97 and 98, you worked with Senator Bob Kerry, Senator John McCain, and Trent Lott to introduce the Iraq Liberation Act, which basically made regime change a part of U.S. policy. And I know that you support entering Iraq and overthrowing Saddam Hussein now. And I think you've said that even if the U.N. Security Council doesn't give its approval, we should go in anyways. Are you worried about some of the unintended consequences, short-term or long-term, of a war with Iraq, particularly if we're doing that war without the support of the U.N. Security Council?
Well, look, it's a complicated question. I'll try to give you a relatively brief answer. John McCain and Bob Kerry, Trent Lott, and I hoped with our legislation that we would have created the conditions in which we were supporting Iraqi opposition to Saddam so that by now they would have been in a position internally to overthrow him and liberate the Iraqi people from his dictatorship and brutality because they probably suffered more than anyone else from it. We're endangered by it. I think we did the right thing, the U.S. did the right thing in going to the United Nations Security Council. But we have a very strong feeling, and we look at Iraq through the lens of September 11th. And we don't want to look back and say, as we did after September 11th, I wish we had done something more decisive to stop al-Qaeda before they struck us. So I think we have to reserve all options. I do think in the current context that we've allowed Saddam to confuse the world about what's happening in Iraq. This is not like a police investigation where we've got to find the evidence. We know that he had chemical and biological weapons that were capable of killing millions of people when he kicked out the UN inspectors in 1998. Saddam still hasn't convinced or even tried to convince the UN what he did with those weapons. And I've seen classified American intelligence, which convinces me that he still has them and he's hiding them, and as long as that's true, the world is endangered. Most particularly, his Persian Gulf neighbors, whose security is important to us, are endangered by Saddam Hussein. So yes, and incidentally, at some point, and this is of the commander-in-chief's choosing, the president's, if he doesn't get Security Council or to get Security Council approval, we'll have to open up more of that classified American intelligence information, not only to the Security Council, but to the American people. And then to make the decision if the Security Council does not approve of, and Saddam doesn't disarm, of military action to change the regime, whether we're prepared not to go it alone, but to create our own international coalition to do it. I'm convinced we'll never have to go it alone. We shouldn't go it alone, but we won't have to.
Are you concerned that at the same, if we go to war with Iraq, at the same time that we become more despised by our enemies, we may become more alienated from our allies who don't support us in that war?
That is a concern, I hope and believe with proper leadership and advocacy that the Bush administration can convince a significant number of allies to support us. And I'd also say that strength in leadership usually convinces people that that a country like ours believes strongly in what we're trying to do. I mean, we're doing something here for a principle. We're taking on a responsibility that a lot of great powers wouldn't take on because we worry that if we let Saddam go, it not only is, we've spent 10 years trying to get him to keep the promise he made to the United Nations at the end of the Gulf War. That's a matter of principle, the strength of international law. It's also particularly a matter of the security of his neighbors, and we're willing to take this fight on. Now, I think that if it has to be, and we win it, as I'm convinced we will, it will strengthen American leadership, and it will change the dynamic in currently conflicted parts of the world, including the Middle East, but only if the Bush administration employs not just the sword, but the plowshare, also uses more economic aid, and is willing to extend itself diplomatically to seize the moment post-Iraq to bring about resolution of conflicts in places like the Middle East.
Joe and Hadassah Lieberman have written a new memoir about the 2000 presidential campaign called An Amazing Adventure. They'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com, from the National Endowment for the Arts, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Destructive Emotions, How Can We Overcome Them? A Scientific Dialogue with the Dalai Lama, narrated by Daniel Goleman. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, religion and politics. We continue our conversation with Senator Joseph Lieberman and his wife Hadassah, also a 60s civil rights activist from the segregated South, and her daughter who grew up in integrated neighborhoods, compare notes on race-related experiences. We talk with Patricia Stevens-Dew and Tanana Reeve-Dew about their memoir, Freedom in the Family.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Joe and Hadassah Lieberman. They've written a new memoir about the 2000 presidential campaign called An Amazing Adventure. This week, Senator Lieberman announced he's running for president. The Democratic candidates for the presidential nomination will be appearing together for the first time later this month in a fundraising event commemorating the 30th anniversary of Roe versus Wade.
Yes.
Usually when politicians speak of their religion in relation to abortion, religion is used to explain their stand against abortion. Mm-hmm. You are an observant Jew. Is your religion guiding your decision, your stand on abortion? And if so, what is it telling you?
Yeah. You know, my religion, like so much else in my life, my life experience, my education, my public service experience informs my decisions, but it doesn't, you know, control them. I mean, my pro-choice record is based on not only my sense of what is right and wrong, generally as a theoretical or philosophical matter, but it is also my own expression of what I believe is right for government and for me as a government leader. And of course, here we have a historic Supreme Court decision, Roe versus Wade, which is the law of the land and sets a standard that I believe makes sense and that we should follow. Incidentally, this issue remains one in which there is a dramatic difference between most Democrats and most Republicans, and certainly between this administration, which has persistently tried to undercut the constitutional right of a woman to make this choice, and Democrats who have persistently supported that right.
So are you saying that your stand on abortion, which is pro-choice, is motivated by your religion, that you're taking that stand in spite of your religion, or that the two are in sync with each other?
Of course, I'm running for president, not for chief theologian. So you get a lot of different points of view in my religion and others, most other religions, on how their religion affects their belief about a very personal issue like abortion. So I say it may have formed my general sense of right and wrong, but my record is here as a public official. It's a longtime consistent record, and it's ultimately what the campaign for presidency is all about.
Hadassah Lieberman, abortion and the right to have an abortion an important issue for you?
Well, I think it's important to give people the right to choose. What I personally believe, or what my husband personally believes, is our belief. So it's really irrelevant to the discussion, in the sense that if you're pro-choice, you're pro-choice.
When you say believe, you mean your religious beliefs, or just your personal beliefs about abortion are irrelevant?
Well, I think personal beliefs, when you're representing people and it comes to something that's so personal and so private, I don't think it's in the public forum.
So you don't feel the need to talk about what you personally think about abortion, but you do
feel the
need to uphold the Supreme Court decision.
I feel there's a need to uphold that decision and to give women free choice.
And if the decision was somehow reversed, would you feel that you need to uphold the reversal of the decision?
No, I don't, we're not dealing with that. Thank God we've got the choice right now, and that's where we are. So why put up a theoretical? I mean, it's irrelevant. It's not going to happen. We're going to have to make sure that pro-choice is available for women.
Can I try an interpretation of my wife? Because we've had this discussion. She doesn't like it when people press me or her about the impact of what somebody thinks our religious doctrine is on a public decision. And I think that's what she's saying, that question is a personal, private one. That is the impact of the religion. Ultimately, we want to be judged on our public record.
Well, taking religion out of the equation, do you feel equally uncomfortable just talking about your personal feelings about abortion, or maybe religion enters into those personal feelings, which makes it difficult to talk about?
I think that our society has made the right decision on this as reflected by the Supreme Court decision, and that the choice ought to be there, but that we also as a society ought to be trying, as President Clinton used to say, to make abortions as safe, legal, and rare as possible. That's, you know...
And respectful to people who have different ideas, personally. We need to respect one another. That's something that I think we've lost a lot these days. You know, we each have our views, and yet, you know, we need to respect the other's view. That's, I think, the problem we have worldwide.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Thanks, Terry. It was a very interesting discussion. I wish you well and look forward to talking to you again.
Joe and Hadassah Lieberman have written a new memoir about the 2000 presidential campaign called An Amazing Adventure. Coming up, a mother and daughter compare notes on the civil rights movement. This is Fresh Air. My guests are a mother and daughter who have written a new memoir comparing their experiences of the civil rights movement. Patricia Stevens Due grew up in segregated Florida. In 1960, when she was a student at Florida A&M University, she joined CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality, and participated in her first civil rights action. It was a sit-in at a segregated Woolworth's lunch counter. After she was arrested, she and four of the protesters refused to pay the fine, insisting on serving their sentences to clog up the jail and bring national attention to their cause. It was the first so-called jail-in. She was arrested in several subsequent protests and has remained an activist. She and her husband raised their children in integrated neighborhoods. In fact, they were the first African-American family in a couple of neighborhoods they moved to. Patricia's daughter, Tanana Reeve-Du, went to private, predominantly white schools until the fourth grade, when she enrolled in a predominantly African-American public school, where she had her first black teacher. Tanana Reeve-Du is a journalist and novelist. Her new book with her mother, Patricia Stevens-Du, is called Freedom in the Family. Patricia Stevens-Du, when you were in the civil rights movement in the 60s, one cop threw a tear gas canister right in your face. He recognized you as one of the leaders, one of the main activists in this protest. And that tear gas canister went off in your face. It affected your eyes permanently. You have to wear dark glasses indoors as well as outdoors a good deal of the time. So your children couldn't help but notice that you had this, like, permanent damage. What did you tell them about it? What moral did you want them to get out of it, that, you know, you can be permanently impaired by activism? I mean, how did you want to tell them about this without it being too frightening? What moral did you want them to get?
Well, from the time they were very young, I was wearing these dark glasses indoors and outdoors, and there weren't many questions asked then, but they learned at a very early age that we had been foot soldiers, actually in a war heaped on us by our own country, and that there were many wounds. And I had one of the wounds that was visible. But they also knew that there were many wounds that you could not see. There were so many emotional wounds. As I think about that day when this tear gas was thrown in my face, there were many people there who were tear gas, and as I was led away by a man, because I could not see right after it happened, who led me to a church. He said he had been in the army. Don't rub your eyes. Put this handkerchief over your eyes. As I sat in that church, I could hear all of the screams of the other students. So what you had to say to your children is that what you did was important, and you had to do it because you had to make a difference. And in my case, I had to be free.
Patricia Stevens-Du, you grew up in the segregated South. And Tanana Reeve-Du, you grew up in integrated neighborhoods. Patricia, I'd like to know if you intentionally wanted to bring up your children in integrated neighborhoods, whether that was a goal or whether that's the way it worked out.
No, actually, that was not a goal, although I think it's important for people to get to know each other. But they ended up in integrated neighborhoods because when my husband and I went house hunting, there weren't any housing available in black middle-class neighborhoods because it was so difficult for blacks to get loans to buy homes that usually once they bought a home, they kept it forever. So because we could not find housing in black neighborhoods, we just started looking for housing in other neighborhoods. Now, just to back up a little bit, I was in Quincy, Florida when Tanana Reed was 3, and my husband and I left because we felt that she needed to be in school and there were no schools available in Quincy at that time for black children. So we moved to Miami and I tried to find a school for Tanana Reeve and we had to take her with us from school to school. And one of the most painful things that ever happened to me was because of our hunt for a school for Tanana Reeve. School after school in Miami, Florida said, whites only. So after a few days of having heard this, Tanana Reeve felt that she had found a solution. She went home, she covered herself with baby powder, her entire body with baby powder so she could be white, so she could go to school, being 3 years old, not realizing that being white meant more than just using something white on your skin, because actually, Tanana Reeve thought her grandmother was white because she was a fair-skinned person. So her solution was to cover herself with baby powder and she would be white.
And I told her, Mommy, can I go to school now? Because I thought, okay, this problem has been solved.
So Tanana Reeve, for your mother, this was very upsetting. What's your memory of that experience?
I absolutely remember covering myself with the baby powder. But I don't remember a feeling of hurt or rejection associated with going with her from school to school. So I think it's just that, you know, in a child's way, you come across a situation, and instead of thinking poorly of myself necessarily, you know, I didn't think I was inferior to anyone at that time, I'm pretty sure. But I just thought, okay, this is sort of an aesthetic problem. I can put the powder on and then, you know, everything will be fine.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Patricia Stevens Due, who is a civil rights activist, a long-term civil rights activist since the early 1960s, and Tanana Reeve Due, her daughter, who is a journalist and a novelist. They've written a mother-daughter memoir of the civil rights movement called Freedom in the Family. Tanana Reeve, your mother grew up in a segregated city. You grew up in integrated neighborhoods. What were some of the things you were up against in integrated neighborhoods? Like you've said, you were called an Oreo. What were some of the problems that you faced in integrated neighborhoods?
I really felt caught in the middle as a young person. It was profoundly painful for me to finally have the exposure on some level I had deeply craved with a lot of black children, only to discover that I was immediately outcast because of their perceptions of me, either by the way I dressed, the way I spoke, my attitude toward my schoolwork, I mean, all these things that I really had gotten from my parents because we were a very education-oriented home. Here I was with this strong sense of history and strong sense of having come from a civil rights family, and the very people, you know, in my mind that my parents had sacrificed for were rejecting me, and that was just on one side. On the other side, we lived in mostly white neighborhoods. Very often we were the pioneering first black family in a lot of neighborhoods. And at one point, one of our neighbors threatened to my mother that if he saw us playing in his yard, he was going to shoot us with his shotgun. Now, my parents never told us this, but there were people from our church, which is a Unitarian church. There were white members of the church sitting outside in the car to patrol the house at night in case someone might try to do harm to us. And then we moved to another neighborhood, and then I became more aware of the problem because my parents had really tried to shield us in the previous neighborhood. But when we moved, it was obvious that people had been throwing tomatoes against the house. The people were throwing rocks against the house. Someone put rocks in my father's gas tank. And that's when I became intimately familiar with the N-word, because young children as young as 5 years old walking down the street would call me nigger. My first experience was one of the first days I was in the new neighborhood walking down the street feeling carefree, and a teenage boy came walking past and muttered just loudly enough for me to hear. "If there's one thing I can't stand," he said, "it's a four-eyed nigger." And I was just shocked because I knew, I mean, the word nigger to me had all sorts of connotations from a long time ago, from the civil rights era, from slavery, for, you know, Knight Riders and burning crosses. And it really had not occurred to me that that would be the sentiment where we lived, but it actually became fairly commonplace for me that I was called nigger quite often, to the point where I realized after a couple of years, I was about 10 years old at that time, by the time I was 12 or 13, I noticed that I had a tendency to walk with my eyes facing the sidewalk. I didn't want to make eye contact. I didn't want to draw attention to myself because I learned to expect outbursts from every person I passed.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Patricia Stevens Dew, a longtime civil rights activist, and her daughter, Tanana Reeve Dew, a journalist and novelist. Their new mother-daughter memoir about the fight for civil rights is called Freedom in the Family. Patricia Stevens Dew, when you were in prison back in 1960 after participating at a lunch counter sit-in to integrate the lunch counter, your father wrote you a letter, and I'm going to read an excerpt of it. He said, "I know that you feel that you are doing a grand and noble thing. Remember this. If either of you get into trouble," meaning you or your sister, "if either of you get into trouble, the very people you are trying to help would never lend you a hand. The facts are really this. About 10 or 15% of our race are just about ready for what you're trying to accomplish. The other 85 or 90% don't care and are not at all interested and would do nothing to aid the cause." Then your father warned that you could be expelled from school and that he could lose his job because he works for the county and the state. What impact did that letter have on you?
At the time, really probably none. My father had been my civics teacher. My father was the person who had taught me I had the responsibility to be involved and I had the right to be a first-class citizen. So as I found that letter a few years ago and reread it, it was really as if I was reading that letter for the first time. But hearing it read and having read it myself in recent years really bring tears to my eyes, because my parents, like the parents of the other persons who were involved, suffered so much. In another letter, he talked about how my mother, he was afraid my mother would have a nervous breakdown. But I wanted to be free, and the others in jail wanted to be free, and even our parents, our grandparents, and no one else could stop us. We were going to do what we thought had to be done in order to be free.
Did you assume that your children would get involved in the civil rights movement and would put their lives on the line the way you had? And did you want them to do that?
No. I did not assume that they would have to do that.
You thought it would be all over by the time they were growing up?
Well, I guess I was a little idealistic on several fronts. In 1954, with the Brown decision about school desegregation, on May 17th, I thought in September all the schools would be desegregated. All the children would be sharing the equipment and having the updated books and all. I was wrong. 2003, we still have some problems.
Tanana Reeve, did you expect to be a part of the civil rights movement? And was there a movement, an obvious movement, to be a part of when you became a college student?
Yes. When I went to Northwestern University in 1983, and I really felt as if I'd been a little civil rights activist in training. You know, there's that age when you're an adolescent, when you're just so full of fire, just ready to help change the world. So I went to the campus, and it turned out to be a fairly conservative campus. So the days of all the pictures I'd seen from Kent State and all of the civil rights demonstrations on college campuses during the 60s didn't quite match the picture of what I found when I went to college. But there was one incident that was very telling. The anti-apartheid movement was really the major movement on campuses during that time. And I found myself sort of really accidentally part of a student takeover. I had just been attending a rally and feeling stirred by speeches I'd grown up all my life, going to NAACP conventions, hearing these stirring speeches. And here were these speeches again, and I felt the fire, and we were all shouting, "Divest now, divest now." And all of a sudden, we were inside the administration building. But when we were warned that we would be arrested because the police were coming, I actually didn't stay. I thought I would stay. I believed I would stay. But somehow my college roommate called me and reminded me I had a dinner date that night. And I ended up slinking out, sort of with my tail between my legs. And I called my mother, really feeling apologetic that night, saying, "Mom, there was a demonstration. I could have been arrested, but I left beforehand." I thought she would be disappointed in me. And in fact, what she said was, "Tananarive, I'm so glad you didn't get arrested. I went to jail so you wouldn't have to." And since that time, I've really had to sort of examine where I think my place can be. And as a writer in particular, working with my mother, both of us researching this book together, I've learned that there are many, many ways that we can create an ongoing civil rights movement, even though we don't have the marches today and the Jim Crow signs.
Magesser Tananarive Due and her mother, Patricia Stevens Due, their new memoir is called Freedom in the Family. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Patricia Stevens Due, a longtime civil rights activist, and her daughter Tananarive Due, a journalist and novelist. They've written a new memoir comparing notes on the civil rights movement called Freedom in the Family. Tananarive, your two sisters married white men. Your husband is African American, but his first wife was white, so your stepchild is half white. I'm wondering if having interracial children in the family is making you rethink what the meaning of race is?
I think the next generation, it will be interesting to see how they grapple with this concept of race. You have talk about kids who want to call themselves multiracial, for example. And, you know, in some cases, it's because they want to honor both sets of parents. And I think in many cases, because our society is still so racist, that there's an eagerness to distance yourself from that label, which has been so painful and which has been used as a brand so much in the past. And I am curious to see how the next generation will grapple with that. But it hasn't shifted my feelings or thoughts about race because, as my mother mentioned, her mother was very fair. My father's mother was very fair. We have always included all colors of the rainbow within that group that is called black.
Since the time of slavery and segregation, as you look at different communities, you see all colors in the black race, totally rainbow colors. So we've always had these colors, but now it's by choice. It's by choice, but it's not making me think differently about race.
Well, I've got one last question for you both, and I'm not sure you'll be able to answer this, but if you could each describe one thing you learned about the other through the process of writing this book together. Tananarive, you want to start it off? Anything you learned about your mother through writing this book together?
I was quite shocked to learn that my mother was actually a normal kid for a time of her life.
as opposed to
because,
what?
Well, you know, I think I had the idea that she and her sister went to college with the notion that they were going to become civil rights activists and help change the world. And it's really only in the research of this book and in talking to her and in reading more about it that I discovered that my mother and sister, like a lot of these kids in these colleges, really went just to get their education. The civil rights movement landed on them. And it was both created by, but also just landing on top of them. So the first 2 years my mother was in school, she went to Roy Hamilton concerts and James Brown concerts. concerts and she practiced her trumpet and she did all the normal things any college student does. And then as a junior, it all changed very abruptly when she was arrested and was part of that jail. And so I was actually very surprised to realize that there's an alternate universe in which my mother would not have been that same activist.
Patricia Stevens, do anything you learned about your daughter from writing this book together?
Well, the thing that I learned about her and the thing that she helped me the most with was to learn how to relax. And our personalities are very different. I'm always serious, too serious many times. But writing this book with Tanana Reeves, she showed me we could relax a bit and still do the book. And in fact, if she had not shown me that, I don't know if we would have been able to finish this book because it was really very stressful. So she gave me a gift. She took my hand and said, let's relax. Let's go to a movie. Let's find that dude ranch. You're always talking about those horses of years past. Let's just relax a bit. And then we'll go into our work. So... I learned to compromise. I didn't mind if she came a little late. I didn't mind if she didn't want to work 23 and a half hours a day. I said, okay, we can work 18 hours a day. So I learned to compromise.
Tanana Reeves, I see what you were up against when you were growing up.
Boy, oh boy. And really, it's funny when you go back to the stories from the movement, you know, the people would sneak around her because she was directing the project and there were very strict rules. And everyone thought my mother was bossy. So she's quite a handful, but she's a very strong and courageous woman. And I am so blessed to have had her as my mother.
Well, it's great to speak with you both. I thank you both for talking with us.
And thank you.
Tanana Reeves Due and Patricia Stevens Due are the authors of the new memoir, Freedom in the Family. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of The Wisdom of Menopause, Creating Physical and Emotional Health and Healing During the Change by Dr. Christiane Northrup. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Matt Damon. His film The Bourne Identity comes out on DVD next week. And we talk with John Ridley, who wrote the screenplay for Undercover Brother, a satire of black action films of the 70s. It's just come out on DVD. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.